Hello and welcome to the Arch Insurance Pursuing Better Together podcast, where we talk to luminaries from both inside and outside the industry about how they have pursued better within their chosen professions. In today's episode, I spoke to Baroness Grey Thompson, DBE, one of the UK's most successful Paralympic athletes, winning 11 Paralympic golds and 6 London marathons, and now a crossbench peer in the House of Lords. In her trademark down-to-earth fashion, Tanny discusses the crucial role that critical friends have played in her success, and how fearing failure shouldn't mean being afraid of putting yourself on the starting line. Here are some highlights from our discussion, but to listen to the full podcast, head over to Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or Google Podcasts. I wanted to start our talk, if I can, by taking you right back to the beginning. I suppose to get an understanding of where you think that early drive and ambition that has seen you achieve so much actually came from.
I think it probably came from my parents, who were both quite strong-willed. In slightly different ways. I think my parents were certainly, incredibly supportive of me. I was born with spina bifida. I could walk a little bit when I was young, but as I grew, my spine collapsed and my own vertebra severed my spinal cord. And my parents made a decision not to treat me any differently, not to wrap me in cotton wool. I think they always, saw the competitiveness in me. Yeah, my parents just encouraged me to be physically active. And that was more about pushing my chair around and living an independent life. And they sort of funneled me into sport and also academia because they just thought it was good for me.
And of course, you said in the past that they really impressed upon you this idea that anything is possible and the wheelchair is not something that should hold you back in any way, shape or form. And it's that, I suppose, that base level of encouragement that you got right from the get-go.
My father was an architect and he knew how inaccessible the world was because he helped build it. And I think they were worried that if they made my world so small, where the house I grew up in was the only place I could live, that I'd never do anything. So, my father refused to make a house particularly wheelchair accessible. And I also had an impairment that, it wasn't such a big deal. I could get out of my chair, I could crawl up the stairs, I could do things for myself. So actually, that was really important for me as a child in terms of, not having everything done for me.
I believe that it was around the age of 13 when you set your sights, as it were, on becoming a wheelchair athlete. In terms of aspiration at that point, that very early stage in your sporting career, how high were you starting to aim at that point?
Definitely 13 was like national level because we had national junior games, which were really competitive because the special school system was good for sport. It wasn't great for anything else. I didn't know about the Paralympics at that point, but I knew about the London Marathon. And I remember watching a Welsh athlete called Chris Hallam, who he was the first disabled person I saw that was really sort of out there. So I do remember at the time 13 saying to my mum, I'm going to do the London Marathon one day. And she's like, oh, okay, that's nice. And then I think 5 years later I did it pretty much the first year I could compete.
One of your many accolades was the fact that you were the first woman to break the 60-second barrier for the 400 metres. And of course, in that kind of a race, you're talking about fractions of seconds that matter, and that commitment to shaving those very marginal sort of times off your total time. That must take a real level of commitment to that constant incremental improvement.
It's never ending. So, to compete in the 100 metres in Athens, which was my last games, my team manager asked me to break my personal best. So I trained for 4 years to break my personal best by 0.01 of a second. As a young athlete, you make these massive jumps. Yes. And the older you get, it gets harder and harder to.
Of course.
But you never know when that jump in improvement's going to happen. And sometimes it takes a really long time. And then sometimes you can just have the most magical season where almost every time you go out, you break a personal best.
A lot of the sort of the personal traits that, that you would associate with a sports person suddenly came into their own when you move outside of that sector or that arena, that determination, that willingness to push, that that desire to constantly aim higher, you know, that must have set you up. That must provide a great foundation in any arena to push forward.
I think one of the most important things with an athlete is that you're afraid of failing, but you're not afraid of putting yourself on the start line where you may fail.
Yes.
So I think what it teaches you to do is, in sport, you're always having to reinvent yourself. You can't just do the same training you did last year. You have to find different ways and different chairs and, you know, different technology. So I think it teaches you to be, it gives you a level of resilience. And it also, I think one of the most important things is that you're not afraid to ask questions. So, you know, because you're constantly asking for feedback as an athlete, and then life outside, you're saying, okay, how do we do this? What are you, and me, you know, moving into politics, I see people who sometimes come from big business who are the experts, and it's really hard for them to ask some of those challenging questions, like, why are we doing this?
Yes.
Whereas sport takes away that fear of just saying, tell me how it works. Why are we doing it? How can I be better? One of the things that you see in business as people move up and get promoted, it sometimes becomes harder for them to build that network around them of like trusted friends or critical friends. In sport, you can't survive unless you've got your training partners who are your critical friends.
Yeah.
Who will. Yeah. And the advice and the feedback is always very immediate. It's kind of in the moment. But I think, you know, some of the stuff I see in business where you get a personal review twice a year, it's not, you know,
it's not enough.
You're trying to figure out what happened 6 months ago.
Yes.
And there is, you know, in our training group, we had a lot of quite strict rules of how you could speak to each other and what you could say, because you couldn't go, that was rubbish. I mean, sometimes, you know, you could say that, but you've got to know and understand the person. So the best coach I've had is then the person who coached me in the way that worked for me, not in the way that he wanted to coach me.
Yes.
And that is really important.
Obviously, one of your roles now is very interesting as a motivational speaker. And what I love is this idea of this encouraging people to always aim higher. Why do you think some people perhaps don't aim as high as they should?
Some of it's fear of failure. You know, I failed a lot in my sports career. I lost a lot of races. You know, I won some big, important ones. I think some of it is confidence, resilience. You know, my resilience goes up and down. It's not always... You know, people will say, oh, you're really thick-skinned. I'm not always. I think it's about that honest conversation with yourself about are you being the best you can be and what else can you do? You know, and I've worked with some very talented younger athletes, and, you know, there was one I remember on the squad that was really struggling, and the team manager said, have a chat with them, you know, to get them to commit to the sport. And at the end of the chat, they decided to leave. This person didn't want to be in the sport. They were there because they felt they should, because of parental pressure, because lots. It wasn't their passion. Mm-hmm. And they're going to hate it. They were pulling some of the team apart because they didn't care. So I think for me, it's about, it comes back to that honest conversation. If you say you want to be the best in the world, are you doing all the things you need to do to be the best in the world?
When you're looking at setting these targets as well, it's how high you are willing to aim, how high, what is achievable, I suppose, without pushing yourself too far. How do you go about establishing that balance as an individual?
Yeah, it's that time to evaluate. And actually, you know, in the business environment, people are really busy. You know, everyone's got a million things they're meant to be doing. And, you know, moving online's been fascinating, but I'm sure, you know, you're always thinking about the next thing you have to do in the next meeting. And so, you know, even now I have time in the day, which is to stop and think. Yeah. It's finding time to reflect or time for yourself. And just to think about, okay, what was good today? What wasn't great? What could I do better? What shouldn't I have done? You know, I get asked all the time about, you know, is there anything I regret from my sports career? Well, not from competing, because I think I did. There's probably a few rows I shouldn't have had. But you then have to own them and go, okay, maybe I shouldn't do, but okay, why will I not do it again? Or why will I do it again and just own it again?
That period of reflection and having that time to reflect and to consider, I suppose, is also key to this idea of continuous improvement.
I think, again, you know, same, everyone's busy and, you know, a million things. And I think, you know, being online, some of it's been amazing because, No, the House of Lords has gone online. I mean, that's never a conversation we ever would have had in a building, an institution that hasn't really changed in 450 years. You know, we've thrown everything out the window. Online's been amazing for lots of things, less travelling, but also it's filled up our diaries in a different way, and that reflection time has disappeared. And so I think a lot of that stuff that I've learned from sport is that, you know, you've got to think about your work-life balance. You've got to think about what you eat and you sleep. And there are times when my work-life balance is shocking, and there's times when it's better. But you've kind of got to even that out, because it's about how you can be effective, not how you can be present. It's really easy to be present. But, you know, it's harder to be effective.
For those in the business arena listening to this podcast today, what advice would you give to those people to help ensure that they can commit to that process of pursuing better together?
I mean, I think the better together is so important, because nobody does it on their own. So I was in an individual sport. But the only time I was really on my own was when I was competing. You know, because you've got your, and I didn't travel with an entourage, but you've got your, you know, your coaches and your physios and nutritionists, and you've got your training partners. And, you know, I think people assumed that, you know, I only trained with GB athletes. It's like, I trained with a whole range of people who brought different things to the training group. And I think it's recognizing the differences and the strengths. And, you know, I used to train with one guy who only really trained when the sun was shining, you know, but he'd come to training sessions and he brought skills. So I think it's recognizing the jigsaw of people. And, you know, that's where diversity and inclusion is really important in terms of that jigsaw. And, you know, for me, it's some of my training group now, they watch the Parliament Channel. I mean, that is above and beyond anything you would ever ask a training partner to ever do. I mean, they mostly say things like you should have brushed your hair, or, you know, your jacket was awful, or the, you know, but actually those things are important in terms of how you present and how, you know, or they'll say, you know, the first 2 minutes of your speech was great, but it was a bit dull. Okay. And so that's kind of a, you know, quite a trusted position for them to say that. But that's how you get better and you improve. And I think it's having that critical friend, that someone you can talk to, that you can offload on, in a work environment, that's, you know, got to be quite carefully thought out and planned. But, you know, for me, I've still got those people in my life. And, you know, in politics, you need a big network of people to do this. So it's kind of really similar. People think it's all really different. It's actually not. In sport, you've got all this training time, and then the races, and you've got the Paralympics was the pinnacle. The stuff I do now, you spend huge amounts of time meeting people, gathering evidence, reading briefing notes and writing speeches. For when you're in the chamber, you've got 2 minutes to take people with you. And I can only do that if I've got a network of people around me who support me to do that final bit. So I might be the bit person who's maybe winning the medal or making the speech that changes legislation. But I think it's really important to make sure you thank and you support and you reward, even by saying whatever way that is, the people who help you get there. And that's why the together stuff is so important, because the best leaders I've seen are the ones who aren't afraid to put really good people around them.